My name is Bill Owsley. I am the retired supervisor of the Kansas City FBI Organized Crime Squad. Read my book, Mobsters in Our Midst, and listen at ganglandwire.com.
Former Kansas City Police Department intelligence detective and now attorney Gary Jenkins produced four documentary films, most recently Gangland Wire. Creator of smartphone app entitled Kansas City Mob Tours. Download it now. If you like what you hear, go to ganglandwire.com. Navigate to the shop page. We need you to put a hit out on our donate button. Gangland Wire True Crime Stories is produced at the Big Dumb Fun Show Studio 4. And now, here's Gary Jenkins.
Well, welcome, you wiretappers out there. I'm here in the studios of the Big Dumb Fun Show in the beautiful Ice House in Midtown, Kansas City, a classic old four-story brick building they used to store ice in back in the turn of the century, in 1920s, I guess. Here with my good friend Aaron. Say hello, Aaron.
Hello, Aaron.
Well, this is the second of a two-part episode, part of the Mob and the Media series, and we have Bulldog John Drummond on the line right now. Hello, John. How you doing?
It's good to hear from you again, Gary. Fine, we're fine. But
all right, that was a great episode last time. We learned a lot more than I knew about the Days of Rage and the Martin Luther King riots, and you were right in the middle of all that.
I remember those very well. You betcha. That's indelible. That's indelible in your mind. It's hard to
I can imagine the images that I saw on TV were quite exciting for me. I was, I think I worked in an assembly plant at that point in time, and it was pretty scary for a country boy like me that all that stuff was going on. And like you said, it was like it was the end of the world there for a while in the later 60s. And it was something. And you certainly got a few adrenaline rushes being out on the streets during that time.
Yes, you would. You would have on that. Absolutely. There's no ifs and buts about that. That's accurate.
I know later in my career, I ended up, I was in an intelligence unit in the 1976 Republican National Convention, and kind of the last dregs of a lot of those guys were here in Kansas City and demonstrating everything. And I was working kind of undercover. I didn't try to be part of them, but I would go in and plain clothes and, you know, blue jeans and t-shirts and just hang out around them. And there were a few adrenaline rushes. Some of those were pretty scary dudes.
I hear you.
They weren't criminals. There's a thing about, I could deal with criminals easier because the criminals know they're wrong. These guys think they're right.
There's a lot about some of the student radicals, not calling students, they weren't that, but most of them came from very affluent families.
Yeah.
Advertising executives, physicians and so on, business executives, they're not people that were in the lower income bracket. They came from went to good schools and came from, particularly in New York, Long Island, places like that, had beautiful homes and things like that. So they were different than, they weren't like you meet the average criminal, that's for sure.
Yeah, they were really interesting times, that's for sure. So tonight we're going to get really into the outfit. One of my early questions I think I have for you is we did a story on the Marlboro diamond heist. That was I learned about that one. It's like, man, this is like right out of TV or the movies. I can't believe there's never been a movie made on this.
Jerry Scalise and Art Rachel, Brain Rachel were the right two people involved, and that's a big story. I remember that 1980 very well.
How did you cover that? Did you?
What happened that day? I recall when it happened. It was in 1980 when these two men actually. Scalise, by the way, had a reputation as an enforcer and some reputation involved in certain murders. And the story broke. The two men had gone into this jewelry store in London called Graff's, which is a very prominent store. They were in the Mayfair section, I think it was in London. I'm not sure what it was, but it was a nice, I think it was Mayfair. So at any rate, they went in there and started to rob the place and obtained what was called the Marlboro Diamond, which according at the time supposedly had a retail value in 1980 of $980,000, probably the largest significant jewel heist that we've ever had. But according to what witnesses said at the time, the two men go in there, brandish these weapons, get the jewelry, put them in a bag, including the Marlboro Diamond, and one of them had a mask, and the mask fell down. It seems like these guys were sophisticated. I can't believe what happened. They went out, and supposedly, they took a car, as you were there, I think they took a cab to go back to the airport, and tried to get back to Chicago, which they did. But the point was, it was so amateurish. In this point, they had registered their hotel. Apparently, they rented a car initially under their own name, which was left on the scene. They took a cab. On the way to the airport, they stopped at the at one of the post offices in downtown London and mailed a package to New York or somewhere like that. And authorities to this day, and by the way, the Marlboro Diamond has never been recovered. And the authorities believe what happened was that they mailed that diamond and other goodies to friends or cronies in the United States, particularly thought it was in New York. And then they boarded a plane. By that time, Scotland Yard had realized who these individuals were. They had cabled ahead to the FBI in Chicago, and they got off of a plane in Chicago, came into O'Hare, and were arrested immediately and searched, but there was no diamond. And by the way, I remember at the time, that made the Walter Cronkite show. We were aware of what was coming in, and that shot of them coming in the plane, so we got that on the air. And it turned out to be quite a story. They were tried in London, and they were extradited back to the Great Britain and did some time there, but the mystery remains. In fact, Scalise himself, it was later, when he got out of prison, apparently, and he's not a kid, he would be a man now about 80 years old, and the other gentleman, Art the Brain Rachel, would be a couple years younger. Apparently, they wanted action. These men, at last report, are still doing federal time. What they did, after they got out of the jail in London and were in the States in Chicago for a while, the next thing we know, they were indicted on two things. Number one, a bank robbery in one of our suburbs, and number two, a break-in at the home of a feared mob enforcer at one time, Angela LaPietra, who was deceased, but his widow and daughter were living there, and they went in and figured that he had money in the house. At any rate, they were arrested again, and here were men in their late 70s being charged because I think they wanted the action. I think they wanted action, and they went back to a prison time, even despite they were geriatric robbers at that time. So the last I heard, the two men are in jail, and the mystery of the Marlboro Diamond has never been solved. And I always thought that our friend, Mr. Scalise, who I talked to, I remember at the last trial he was at, in connection, that is, the trial where he was involved in the bank robbery and the break-in, attempted break-in at the house of this mob figure, former mob figure, that he would, number one, write a book, and I think he was figuring on a movie deal, because if you might have seen a movie came out in 2008 about John Dillinger. He was used as a consultant that time. I remember that much. That was before he got involved in the most recent trouble. But to my knowledge, he can tell what happened to the Marlboro Diamond. We don't know to this day. Was it broken up? I think most jewel experts tell me they would have been too hard to sell a rock like that in one piece. They think it's been broken up, if that's the case. At any rate, the mystery of the Marlboro Diamond is still with us, one of the biggest jewel heists of all time, and so far nobody's talking. So there's a mystery for you right there.
Were you at the airport then? You were with
the crew? No, I was at the station. I didn't go to the airport when they came in. I didn't go there, but I was later that night when they brought him over to the Dirksen Federal Building, when they came in a car, two FBI agents brought him in a car and took him downstairs in that building.
And
but
you were there
that
for
time,
that.
I had an opportunity to talk to Scalise at that last trial. I was at the federal building when he was indicted and when the trial started. Not in camera, but talk in this hallway about it. But he wouldn't tell nothing. He wouldn't go and tell me whatever the Marlboro Diamond. He didn't want to tell. As I indicate, that still is a mystery. And that was a big, big mystery. That was quite a heist. And as you indicated, I think that would be a great movie to be made about it. No ifs and buts about it.
Well, do you think that when they stopped at the post office along the way, they obviously must have mailed whatever it was that they had robbed of the from the jewelry store?
Absolutely. There's no question that the material was the diamond and it was in that package. And authorities, they thought, they checked with one person here by the name of Scarpelli in Chicago. They thought he might have gotten that diamond. They denied it. They thought he had a relative in New York that might have gotten the diamond. But all attempts to find and locate that loot, that swag, have been unsuccessful. Have been unsuccessful completely. And so that mystery remains with us. And I thought by now, frankly, what I thought would happen, that Scalise would come up, and once he did his time, he's done his time, would say what happened to the diamond and make a few bucks of the book and then a movie, but it has not happened yet. I don't know. I'm surprised.
Well, maybe one of the reasons, I mean, you would think that these gentlemen working with the outfit out of Chicago would not just act independently without some kind of authorization, even though it was in London, you would think, because they would have to wet the beaks of the folks above them.
Oh, there's no question about it. It was an outfit. I'm sure that the score the proposition was that they were going to, the leadership in the outfit was going to get a cutout. If they didn't operate independently, no way. There's no way about that at all. I think that's, but anytime scores like that, Mr. Scalise has always been alleged to have been involved in several major armored car robberies in the area, and one in Hammond, Indiana. There was big loot on those, and of course, when that happened down, the outfit elders get, of course, a certain cut of that swag, out of the money on that. And that, I'm sure, was the same case with that. And I'm sure also, even though times have changed, they were probably told to keep their mouths shut, but of course, that's 37 years ago. The people that are in command then are no longer around, of course, but still, there's nothing that's happened. And Scalise, by the way, while he was in London, here's a sidebar story. He lived in a suburb, a southwest suburb, and the FBI got from an informant told me there were some bodies buried on his property there, and lo and behold, they did find, they opened up, they started digging, and there was at least two people that were gangland slayers, victims that were found when they tore up that property. But of course, Scalise never had to shed any light on that either, I might add, needless to say.
But my knowledge, at that point, they were more concerned about the diamonds?
Yeah, well, that's correct. The diamond, of course, is still the big story. And as you indicated, as before we went on the air, that's a story in itself. But yeah. To my knowledge, that nothing has ever happened on that. Nothing at all.
So you don't think that break-in that he did after he got out had anything to do, maybe,
with
that
person
connected?
No, I don't think so.
Connected?
I think it didn't make sense with the fact that he wanted to rob this bank and case the bank, and also the fact that they had heard. The reason why you say, my gosh, that's, you don't go into a former mob leader's house and break in. But another mob leader was imprisoned by the name of Frank Calabrese, and the FBI broke into his house and found out all this jewelry and value that he'd stashed away. So I think apparently Scalise and Rachel said, hey, I bet if that guy had that, Calabrese had that kind of dose, La Pietra has the same, so let us go in and get some of that swag, figuring it's there. But they never broke in. They were there on the scene, and that's when they got arrested.
I read about that. The FBI had them wired and were waiting for them at La Pietra's house.
Absolutely. Now, we got another thing about that. I believe at that time, we're going back now 7 or 8 years when this happened, maybe not quite that long, that we had video of the actual, they were of showing these people by the bank and that type of stuff. I bet they were using, the FBI was using drones. They refused to say how they got that visual, how they got pictures of him going in that place. And then they had bugged the car. They had bugged these guys as well. So they heard the conversations. In fact, amusing thing about it, before they went in, how they wired this vehicle they had. But there's a third man with him. It was a lower echelon guy, and he had to urinate. And he said, I can't hold it much longer. So they decided to go into the home right away. But those are some of the sidebar stories with it. But that's a very fascinating story. There's no denying that.
Well, but they were following him at that point after he'd been released from prison because he was their best lead to the Marlboro Diamond.
Yeah, that's correct. He was a London kid. They did their time in London, both Rachel and Scalise. Did their time in London. They did their time in the Isle of Wight, wherever it was. And so they came out free men. They were not on probation, anything like that. They came out as ex-cons, but they had they like any other citizen, though, they could do whatever they wanted. And apparently at that age, I still go to my grave figure, and I think these fellows did that last two jobs they tried to do because they wanted some action. I really believe that. I don't think financially they needed to do it. I don't think they had to do it. I just think they wanted, I think some guys like that type of life. There was too much of a challenge for them, and they did it and got caught.
Do you think that, when they didn't ever recover the diamond, and there's obvious evidence that there was a mailing of a package, the odds are that even though there was media coverage of this event, which was probably national news, no postal worker suddenly quit their job.
Not to my knowledge. In fact, I'll tell you something. I went to London. My wife and I, as a trip, and I went to Graff's jewelry store, and I went in there and said, Mulder Ron, can I help you, sir? And I wanted to talk to the manager. And the moment I brought up the Graff jewelry thing, he didn't want to make any comment about it. So I was persona non grata that. There was one story I've heard. How true this is, I don't know. That perhaps that it was an inside job. Now, this is the last straw that I heard on how true this is, that maybe that the... I don't think that's the case, but in other words, the proprietor, the Graff people themselves were involved in this thing. And it was a phony deal, so they get the insurance money or something out of that. How true that is, you hear a lot of what I call the train rumors going around. But this point, I didn't omit that after the heist happened, when they walked out of the jewelry store, there was a young couple out for a lunch. They were working nearby on their walk, and they saw these guys come out of the store. And as I indicate, this, I think it was Rachel, had a mask on that fell down on his face, and they saw him get into this car. So right away, they called Scotland Yard. So that was the end of those guys who were apprehended. As I say, they got on plane, but then that was too late. By the time they got to Chicago, the ball game was over.
Yeah, but they never talked. And so
No, they came directly from London to Chicago. So the only way that that diamond could have, what happened to that, when they made that stop at the post office, then that's obviously where they had got rid of the swag. That's no question about that.
Well, speaking of breaking into mob guys' houses, didn't you cover the, when there are two guys killed that were breaking into houses up around Accardo's neighborhood?
Oh, that's unprecedented. And by the way, I may tell you right now that my knowledge of the movie being famed, or maybe it's done in Toronto, Canada, not in Chicago, about Tony Accardo, but the theme is pretty much about the break-in into his house in 1978. And I got to tell you what that was about. What happened was, Accardo was a friend of a jeweler that had a place on the north side, and some hotshot burglars, John Mandel was the name of the ringleader from Lincolnwood, which is a suburb, who was considered one of the best burglars that the outfit had, decided around Christmas time to break into this jewelry store, and got a tremendous haul they pulled out of there. It turned out, however, that the owner of that store was a friend of Accardo. And the man called Accardo and said, look, what's happened, we've had this break-in, blah, blah, blah. They've taken this, they've taken that. And because he was a friend of Accardo, Accardo was sympathetic to him. And he got ordered, and it was an outfit break. I mean, they had to pay proceeds to obviously the top of the loot, to the outfit. They soon found out who they were, and Accardo ordered those people to return the jewelry to him. In other words, to take them over to his house, the jewelry, the money and everything, to the house that they got. And then he would turn it back to the jeweler. It turned out that the John Mandel, as I indicated, was the ringleader with four or five other guys. And apparently the young guys started to figure, hey, this isn't right. We do this score. We do the work. A perfect job. And now the old man sitting out in California says, hey, got to turn the stuff back in. That's not right. They broke into his house. He lived in River Forest at that time. He was not there at that time. He was in California. And broke into his house and got the swag back, got the jewelry and everything, got money and all that stuff out of there. And apparently, Accardo, I heard from a FBI agent that he had an informant that, quote, they had never seen the old man, meaning Accardo, so angry. When he found out that they had broken into his house, he ordered what the story was. He wanted these people apprehended, and not only apprehended and killed, but tortured before they died. Now, right away, you say, how do they know for sure who did it? Well, what they remember during Vietnam, we call it blanket. The B-52s were blanket bombing. In other words, they just drop bombs all over the place. Figure collateral damage. You get some. You might innocent people might be killed, but that's law of the jungle. We're going to get the right people. So they started. It's all of a sudden, these burglars started ending up in trunks of cars, and it was obvious why they were in those trunks, because they felt that they were the ones involved in the break-in. It turned out it was a trial called Family Secrets. In 2007 and 8, that the story came out that a man named Frank Calabrese had orchestrated a lot of those murders to placate Mr. Accardo. So those were solved as far as the jury was concerned. And several people, including Calabrese, were convicted and went to jail. But that was unprecedented. A break-in in Tony Accardo's house was unbelievable. That's major business. As I indicate, there is a movie. By the way, Robert De Niro had the lead role originally. And apparently, for some reason, he dropped out of it. And the last I heard, Sylvester Stallone was taking the place of Accardo. That's in the movie. When it comes out, I don't
know. That does not sound good to me, but we'll see. I will not. I'm suddenly, not a movie critic.
Yeah, suddenly the big tuna's got like this New York accent.
Yeah, well, Stallone, that's right. That's my understanding. I haven't. And it's shot also in Toronto for financial reasons. It was not shot in Chicago.
Probably didn't use De Niro for financial reasons too. And
Stallone
I think was a lot cheaper.
The story I heard was De Niro was paid to do this. Came in, and for some reason or other, then they had a problem between the producers. And I think a French outfit was shooting the picture in Toronto. And there was a fallout between the producers, that is, the working people, and the people that bankrolling the French. The thing was held up, and De Niro said, I'm out of here, and still got quite a few bucks out of it.
Wow.
And then they hired Stallone to take the part of it. And the last I heard, this was 2 or 3 months ago, that they were shooting it and still in Toronto, and I assume they must be done with the darn thing by now, unless there's no other problems. When the release date is of that, I don't know. I don't know the name of the title, but I do know that the thrust of it is about the burglary of Accardo and the murder of the intruders, the burglars.
Interesting.
Quite a yarn.
You know, in researching you, I see in another interview that they ask you about the Billy Dauber case.
Well, there was one, I'll tell you, that Billy Dauber, Billy Dauber was a man of, he was a South Suburban resident, but his job was to keep the chop shops in line. And let me explain what that is. The outfit soon began to find out there was more money when you steal a car, not to peddle it in an attack. Say, steal a 1975 Cadillac. Break it up and chop it up, and there's more money in selling the parts to it. So the result was that these people who were stealing the automobiles would take them over to the yards, as they called some of these chop shop yards, some of these auto yards in the south suburbs. There was a lot of them. And then the vehicles would be chopped up, and then the parts would be sold. Much more lucrative than it was to sell the car per se. Dauber's job for the outfit, they claimed, was to keep those yards in line. And some of those that were not paying their street tax to the mob, they were trying to get away with that, and his job was to keep them in line. If they didn't do that, he would kill them. So he had the reputation of being one of the biggest hitmen in Chicago history. How many people he killed, I think a newspaper in Indiana claimed it was around 30. I don't believe that's that many, but he did definitely, he was a feared guy. There's no question about it. Dauber was very feared. Well, it so happened the government, of course, was putting pressure on him. And what happened was they arrested him on a minor drug charge. And what happened was he started cooperating. He started cooperating with Uncle Sam with the strike force, apparently naming names and see who was responsible for this and that. Well, the outfit soon found out about it. And Scalise, by the way, was one of those who found out about it, what I was told. In fact, also, he was involved in it. Anyway, what happened was on July 2nd, 1980, at Will County Courthouse, I remember this because I went to the cover of that story today that it was a minor court case. But I said, we need to get more pictures of Billy Dauber. So I went down with the crew, and we got Dauber coming out of the building afterwards. I noticed he was very subdued. Usually he's a very angry, hot-tempered guy. It just seemed like a different personality. He just went by and walked, says, how are you? That boom, walked away. We got ready to put our gear away. And when he came back, I wanted the crew to follow him to his new home, because I heard he was very protected. He was worried about getting hit. It looked like a castle. It looked like almost a fort. And the supervisor at the station, no, you can't do that. I got another story for the crew. You come back with a courier. We got another story for you. So no sooner did I get back to the station. Now, this is in Joliet, which is about 45 miles away from the station. I got back into the station and into my office. The phone rang. The guy picked it up. I picked it up, and he said, your pal got hit today, bang, and shut the door down. And then I found out later that the Will County Sheriff's Office I contacted, they said Dauber had been killed along with his wife. And leaving, that they had left. In other words, authorities later pointed out, it came out during the trial, by the way, the family secrets trial, that Calabrese and the other people, the assassins, were sitting outside the courthouse when we took Dauber out there. Dauber got into his car. And they followed him down a road, a county road, county highway, to his home and ambushed him there. They blocked him as two cars. They blocked, one of them was a chase car, and blocked him in front, and then they took shotguns and killed both of them. It was a very brutal murder. And by the way, also, everybody, there are several people indicted in that, including Frank Calabrese. His brother was also responsible, a guy named Scarpelli, and a guy named Butch Petroselli were the shooters, and also supposedly named in court our good friend Jerry Scalise. But nothing ever happened on that. Scalise was never charged in that thing. And he never was indicted or anything like that, so that might have been street talk. But Scalise's name surfaced in that murder as well, as I'm sure Jerry will remember.
But
that was an incredible story. Also, but the fact is, we got the last moments. I think after we made that shot of Dauber leaving the courthouse, I think he was dead within 15 minutes of the time he left. So it was quite a shock. In fact, I have to admit, I went into the newsroom because they had another story for me, and they didn't know what to do with this. What are you going to do? I said, what are you going to do with this Dauber thing? I got video of him. Well, no, maybe we'll make what we call a voiceover mention. He was in court today on drug charges. Well, I think he needs a little more room than that. I said, the guy, what about him being hit today? Is that worth any few more minutes? What? They didn't know that because I just had the call. So that, at least I had the last laugh on them. But to this day, I told if the crew would have followed him, I recommended when I called in, I said, I can't, I'm busy, you got me something to do. Can the crew follow him? I want to see his new house, his new fort. Had they followed him, Lord knows what's going to happen. I told the crew, I said, look, if you'd have followed him, you might have come on scene when the shooting occurred, and you'd have had the story of a lifetime. And if you got killed, if the guy saw you and he witnessed it, then you'd be shot. But it's a win-win situation, because then their wives would get double indemnity. Either way, you're going to be a winner. They didn't agree with me on that.
That would be even a bigger story if they'd got shot. That would be cool.
Oh, yeah. Well. I hate to say it, but the station would love that. The numbers, oh, it would go through the roof. I bet you it is. Don't kid yourself.
There might have been a third car, another one from the station.
Right. But Dauber, that's one murder that was solved, that was cleared. And as I say, a man by the name of Calabrese, Scarpelli, and a man named Butch Petroselli were involved in, and Frank Calabrese, who turned state's, was the brother turned state's evidence on him, and he was the one who told a lot about that. So that's one murder that was finally cleared. A lot of homicides and gangland murders for years were never being cleared.
Now,
that didn't happen much.
Was, John, was that when cleared when they in the family secrets trial?
Yeah, that's it, right. It that's when it came out during 2007. The murder was 1980. So you turn the pages of time back on that. And that only came out because during the family secrets trial, one of the killers decided to cooperate with the authorities and spill the beans, so to speak, and became the key witness.
Well, see, if you'd had caller ID back then, you might have known who they were.
That's correct. The funny part of it, the person called in did not call the newsroom number, called my office number, which whoever made that call obviously knew I was there and gave me a shot. And then, a shot in the ribs, like to say, hey, buddy, your friend is gone. And that's interesting to find out who made that call to this day.
If you think about it, John, they saw you outside the courthouse because they were watching. And
they were there. That came out during the trial. There's no question. In fact, Frank Calabrese on the stand at the trial had mentioned my name, how I had made the story. He didn't say I was outside the courthouse, but he said how we broke the thing or something like that. No, they knew I was there, all right. But let's face reality. In Chicago, at least, I can't talk to other major areas. As far as the mob, there has never been anybody in Chicago that has been killed by the outfit that was not working with the outfit. The only exception would be back in the 30s, a man by the name of Jake Lingle. Jake Lingle was a reporter for the Chicago Tribune. And he was shot in the Illinois Central Railroad Station by some of Capone's gunsels, as they called them. And Colonel McCormick, who at that time was running the Tribune, was enraged that one of his own men, one of his own reporters, had been gunned down by the Capone mob.
Really?
Well, the next day or two, one of the reporters from the Tribune told Mr. Colonel, he said, Colonel McCormick, I think we better back off on this because it turns out that Lingle was on Capone's payroll. So that murder was you couldn't say that he was killed because he was a reporter, because he had a financial problem with a beef with some of the Capone people. And the only person I know that we had a case, believe it or not, here in Chicago, that of a woman at the time in 1957, I remember this, by the name of Molly Zelko was her name. She worked for a newspaper in Will County. That's where Dauber was, by the way. It exposed gambling down there, a weekly paper, and she disappeared in 1957. She's never been seen since. And there's no question about it. She was met with foul play. I don't think there's any argument about that.
So you don't think that maybe that phone call to you that day, to your direct line, wasn't sort of a veiled threat as well?
Well, I suppose it could have been. I didn't look at it that way. I think it was more that just wanted to show, see, wise guy, see what happens. We know what's going on. We got the last laugh on you, something like that. Be then advised, it's always been a fact, particularly in Accardo, when the syndicate or the outfit in Chicago was very well disciplined. And Accardo was smart enough to know that supposing they killed a reporter, whether it was newspaper, print, radio, or television, whatever the case might be, it would be counterproductive because there'd be so much heat on them. In other words, there'd be a coalition of newspaper people and electronic people putting pressure on the federal authorities, particularly, to solve that murder. And that in a lot of heat, they'd been brought up before grand juries. And the only other one I remember was Victor Reisel, who was a syndicated columnist in New York on labor racketeering. And he had exposed some labor racketeers, Johnny Dio and some of those guys in New York. He's walking down the street in Manhattan. Guy comes up to him and says, "This is for you, Vic." Boom! They threw acid into his eyes. He was blinded.
And then
those are the only cases I know of organized crime where the reporters have been the victims.
Or there was the famous one we talked with Larry Henry in Las Vegas of Ned Day's car being firebombed.
Well, I know Ned Day. Yeah, Ned Day died. I know Ned Day well. I used to visit Ned, and we contacted when I was out there. Ned died, if I remember, of a heart attack in Hawaii. I think it was. He was about 42 years old.
It just somebody firebombed his car a few years before that.
Yeah, that's correct.
A year before that.
A warning. Yeah, I don't think it. Remember, I talked to Ned about it. He thought it was it was a warning. You're right. But Ned was never. That was the only thing with Ned. And Ned took it. Ned had a pretty good relationship with those guys. Of course, Vegas is it was a small town compared to around here. But he had heart. He had a column there in the paper, and then he had a radio show. Oh, Ned was a hard hitter, a good man. And by the way, do you know that Ned Day's father? When I was a kid growing up, we used to see in the newsreels bowling shows, bowling experts. One of them was a guy, Ned Day, and I asked him one time, "Was you in relation to Ned Day?" He says, "Yeah, that's my father." So his father was one time one of the top bowlers of all time, you know, at that period, in the 40s.
Interesting. It was up in Milwaukee. I think he was from Milwaukee.
Yeah, that's West Dallas. Actually, West Dallas was a suburb of Milwaukee. Okay. That's correct. That's where Ned Day was from.
Which is where Ned, I thought, when we talked about this, kind of got a little bit of his taste into knowing some of the folks that were the mob.
Well, I'll tell you, Ned Day knew Las Vegas the back of his hand as far as the outfit there. He's certainly very, very knowledgeable about it. There's no question about it. And bear in mind also, I ran out there to do a story in Spalato one time, and we made the mistake of going to the police department and trying to find out where you could get pictures of the guy. And apparently Joe Blasco got wind of it, who was a corrupt cop, and tipped off Spalato. So we staked out this house where he supposedly went jogging. He never came out because he was told that we were here. And those, we never got pictures of that. The police department had that problem. Several of them were on the take for the mob, and Blasco was the most famous name of that at all. But Spalato was fear. I'll tell you one other quick story on that. That I wanted, when we did this story beforehand, I said, I want to get some video of Tony Spalato. So I contacted a freelance cameraman out there. This was when Spalato first came there. And he didn't know much about him, except I said, he's got this boutique in the Circus Hotel. And he hangs out at the Las Vegas Country Club, who plays gin rummy there every day. I don't have it. And I think I gave him his address of his home. So he said, oh, no, no problem. Bang, bang. I'll do it for you. I do a lot of stuff. Bang. He called me back 48 hours later. He said, what are you trying to do? Get me killed? You didn't tell me who this guy was. And so, unfortunately, he didn't get any pictures. He realized then who he was. And he said he was a much feared guy out there. No question about it.
And then what happened? His price doubled?
Yeah, he doubled his price.
I need the coverage.
Really? So, Don, as you, you know, you eat and drink in Chicago, how was it very common to run into any of these guys and have conversations?
Oh, you would, of course. Sure you would. You'd run into my room in the federal building. I'd run into guys on the golf course, things of that nature. Some guys would call and give you a hard time. You might say that they'd call and tell you your ancestors were a four-legged variety and a few things like that. But I had a certain amount of immunity. And actually, you can't bum rap. The only time we had trouble really got some guys hot. We did a story on how the mob was moving, the leadership of the mob was moving out to the suburbs. Most of them in the past had lived in Chicago, not really fancy houses and that, although Carter was in River Forest. It was very nice. And we called the guy that was there was a television show called Lifestyles of the Rich and Famous.
Oh, yeah, I remember that.
We call the stories Lifestyles of the Rich and Infamous. And we had the same guy that did the narration, whose name escapes me right now, the narration on that. For that show, to do our show, to come into our piece. We had a three-piece series, a two-piece series. We called Lifestyles of the Rich and Infamous.
Cool.
And some of them didn't like that because it showed their homes in Barrington and some of these very, very, very nice areas that they were living in at that time. Things like that give you a little static. But you can't squawk. If a guy's indicted, he goes in the federal building and before a grand jury, before he goes in for a bond hearing or whatever the case might be, or a trial, I mean, he's open game. He's got no squawk about that at all. I don't think. But
no.
Sometimes, yeah, you try to get the guys coming out of a house or something like that. They get a little hot. They get a little hot about that. I can't say we ever, because our thing we did was put them behind bars. There's one exception. It still hurts me to this day. I did a story with a man by the name of John DeJohn. That name means nothing, although there's a fight group in Syracuse by that name. But this fellow, John DeJohn, his father was a gangster called Nick DeJohn, who was murdered out in San Francisco in the 40s. John DeJohn was a minor hoodlum. He did trials and burglary and some check kiting and a few things like that. And he wrote me a letter that he was getting out of jail in Leavenworth and he wanted to tell stories about the mob out of school. Apparently he got disillusioned. So I warned him. We did this interview, did the piece, and he was still at the MCC at that time. He hadn't been released. The MCC is the Metropolitan Correctional Center. He'd done his time in the Leavenworth prison. He was doing about 90 days in the MCC, going to be released. So we interviewed him there and did the story where he named names. And I obviously, I told him, warned him before. I said, you know, doing this could jeopardize your health and so on. And he said, no, I'm going ahead. He wanted to go. He was bullheaded to do this. He insisted on doing it. He said, I'll go somewhere else. And what happened was he was released and he called me after he got out of jail. He was living on a hotel, just got out of jail, a hotel in the Rush Street area there. And he said, I can't talk to you now. I just got out. We got to meet, but I got to be very careful because I've alienated a lot of people. 2 days later than that, he was killed in an alley, pumped with 8 bullets in him on the northwest side. And I felt there's no question about it, that I felt guilty in the way on this. And I still feel fat about it. I think there's no question that his relationship with me probably caused his demise. In fact, one of the Area 5 detectives said he was too friendly with you. The word got out they were spilling the beans, talking too much, and they didn't like that.
That
was the only case I had like that. But
had you already published the story?
Pardon? Oh, we ran the story.
You ran the story. And then after that, he calls
you back. Absolutely. We ran the story. We did, first of all, I did a story originally on him when he was in MCC. And then, of course, after the incident where he was slain, in that case, I couldn't, that case never got off the ground. In other words, he was just he was not a big shot. And I don't think the Area 5 or the police, I don't think there was a great deal of effort to finally clear who it was, because he was a hoodlum in those days. Yeah, one less hoodlum to worry about. In fact, I did interview, not on camera, a guy by the name of Popeye was his name, and his name had surfaced that he was one of the wolves who had killed this John DeJohn, but he denied it to me on camera, which is rather amusing. Usually they don't talk to you. But, oh, no, he said, I had nothing to do with DeJohn. Absolutely not. So that's the end of that story. But to this day, to my knowledge, well, that was 1981 who he's killed, so that case is gone now, and it's a tragic story, a very tragic story. Mr. DeJohn, young DeJohn, he was not, it was a tough story. He shouldn't have done, I mean, he insisted on doing it, so we went ahead with it, and he paid, I'm afraid, I have to admit that he paid with his life, and I think that one of the reasons, but I can say, I'm sure another television station or something else would have done the same, so that's water over the dam now, I guess, but
well,
I remember that case very much. It didn't get much ink or anything like that, but it was certainly, to us, it was a big story.
You would get your assignments at that point from an assignment editor, no one called
right,
you to
here's
say,
the thing,
hey,
working, you know,
John DeJohn has been shot, why don't you go cover that?
Well, we covered it with story when it happened, but as I say, we don't know. We did a story, interviewed detectives on it, and because we had done the story with the John before. But as I indicated, we're about the only ones that made any play. And I still have a newspaper clipping of it that, you know, the former gangster was found body. He said 10 bullets in his body in an alley and on the garage. They didn't indicate what the cause was at all. And as I indicate, I think that in that period, there was a lot of homicides that were gang-related, and a lot of them weren't being cleared, and particularly if it wasn't a big-name guy, it wasn't a heater. And nothing, I don't think, much was done on that case, and it was probably tough to clear it to begin with. And so John also, by the way, don't blame me only, also, by the way, he had contacted federal authorities. As a matter of fact, he had named people that hung out in one hotel called the Maryland Hotel. He listed the number of people that would be frequenting in these places, what their jobs were in the North Side Mob. So you can't, he also was singing away to the FBI. So that made me feel a lot better. I think that was an issue too, although I think, frankly, the real problem was that he talked to the media.
He had a death wish, it seemed to me like.
Yeah, I think he did. I'm afraid to say that. I think he almost did. I think I have to mention that in my narration when I did the story of he got killed.
Yeah.
I really felt that way. I think he almost had that death wish. He was irresponsible. When he was spilling his beans, he knew enough that that type of thing was could be tantamount to his own murder, and it was.
Maybe he knew that.
Not a big story. Didn't get much ink at all because I was, you know, it was, as I indicate, the newspaper, the other stations, I don't think did anything with it. Just a couple of columns in a newspaper. A man was found shot to death in an alley on the northwest side.
I mean, a lot of times in this world that you worked in, these guys would catch a case on something that wasn't necessarily a major case, but they were trying to make something on them. And as a result, the outfit, if you will, getting nervous that some, you know, that information was going to get out would kill these guys.
Oh, yeah, they're definitely. Oh, yeah, if they feel that you're going to talk, there's no question about it, you're a target. Particularly in the mob's heyday, it was very well disciplined. And at one time, they were very bitter about anybody involved in drugs could be killed. Particularly you, but they were very stringent on those on their views, and they would that's one thing, they would definitely reciprocate with violence. There's no denying the Chicago mob was probably the most feared group. And remember, it was a very monolithic mob. There's no crew. There was five crews, but they all were under one leadership. Unlike New York, we have all those families, a lot of mustache peeps running around. But Chicago was very well disciplined.
It's just like Ken Ito, Tokyo Joe. I mean, he told Solano, he said, you know, hey, yeah, I got a case and I can take it. It's not going to be that much time. I can take it. And
they didn't believe him.
They didn't believe him.
Biggest mistake made with the truth. People who don't recognize who the man by the name of Ken Ito, they called him Tokyo Joe. He was the organized crime, the outfit's expert on what they call the Bolita racket. That was a game, a numbers game played in by the Puerto Rican people in Chicago. And he was responsible for that, among other things. And he was arrested in a gambling raid. And apparently the leadership of the mob, some of the top leaders felt, this guy cannot, we can't risk it. He could spill the beans on us. And that was a guy who I think you mentioned, he blamed a man named Vince Solano. So the story was told, what happened was that Ken Ito was free on trial, free on bond, scheduled to go on trial. when one of his friends called him and said, hey, look, we want to get together with the Solano and these people and straighten this thing out, okay? Well, they'll meet you tonight at a certain location, these two fellows, a man by the name of Jasper Campisi and a man by the name of John Gattuso, were to pick him up and take him, that is he, Canetto, to this restaurant where he's to meet this mob guy to settle this issue, to show that, hey, resolve this thing so I don't have to have any problems or to do my time. And he would have done it. He was just what they call a stand-up guy. Well, they didn't believe that. So what happened, they drove into this parking lot, and Edo was pretty streetwise, wondering what the heck they're doing. He was sitting in the front seat. The guy behind him pumps something like 7 bullets into his skull out of a .22. And some of them hit, some of them did not. There was some of them maybe jammed off. At any rate, the man had at least 4 or 5 bullets in his head, three or four bullets in his head. He feigned he was dead. And so they jumped out of that car and ran into their own vehicle and fled the scene. Edward, meanwhile, gets up, bleeding badly from the head, and staggers across the street. There was a drugstore. Goes in and tells the people at the pharmacy, I've been shot, call 911. And there was sort of a comedy at that when they called at first that apparently the dispatcher didn't know what it was talking about, thought it was all baloney. But eventually, the authorities came onto the scene. The fire department took him to a hospital, and they saved his life. And right away, the Justice Department people came right down there from the strike force and told Edo what had happened. And Edo, by that time, was no longer a stand-up guy. They tried to kill him. And that's when, of course, he identified the two people that shot him were responsible for shooting, again, by the name of Jasper Campisi from suburban River Forest. The other man by the name of John Gattuso, who happened to be a deputy sheriff for the Cook County Sheriff's Department. Campisi was an old-time mumster, and apparently felt he could do what he wanted, because the federal authorities, Dan Webb at that time, I think was the head of the Justice Department at that time in Chicago, the U.S. attorney, they picked him up, talked to these guys, said, do you realize, gentlemen, Mr. Campisi and Mr. Gattuso, what you've done, you botched this murder, you botched this assassination. The outfit is not going to let you live like that. You cannot do that. The smart thing for you to do is come forward, play ball with us, we'll put you in witness protection program, and you could live happily ever after. Campisi thought, no. I'm a friend of Accardo. I've been a longtime pal of these guys. They're not going to do anything like that. So Campisi and Gattuso are free on bond. And the next we know, these two bodies are found in a trunk of a car in suburban Naperville on a hot July night. This is 1983. The bodies of Campisi and Gattuso were both found there, both dead. And they botched a job and they paid for it with their life. And by the way, there's another case that has not been solved. We don't know who the shooters were, and nobody was ever charged, no indictments, nothing like that. So there's another mystery for you Hawkshaws out there.
The Frank Calabrese didn't know who did that one.
He probably knew, but they never linked it in that trial to who did it. No, they never did. As they said, that was settled out of court, as they said at the time.
Yeah.
And that's never, so there was never, no, that has never been cleared as long as it's been there, which is too bad. So we don't know who, in fact, some of the high-profile cases like the Dorfman case and others, that are Gene Khanna, those have never been cleared officially as to who killed who and so on and so forth. So there's a lot of mysteries left with organized crime murders. Don't kid yourself. They
really
haven't been solved.
Here's one. We did this story. We interviewed this Chicago policeman that wrote a book, Jim Paydar.
Uh-huh.
And he titled his story, Janitor in a Drum. Are you familiar with that? Where they?
What's the name of that title again?
Janitor in a Drum.
No, I don't think so, as a matter of fact.
Well, it's an interesting story. There's these, and I can't remember their names now. There was two mob guys that went to this third mob guy's sandwich shop there in Chicago. And
oh, they're talking about Richard Kane being murdered and that drove the sandwich shop.
No, this isn't that. This is a different one. And so they go in and they
they're juice collectors.
Yeah, they're juice collectors. They think he owes them some money. He doesn't think he does. He kills them both. He puts them in a couple of used drums, 55-gallon drums.
Oh, yes, that happened before. Yeah, I remember the case. They found two guys in the drums. Yes, I remember that. Yes.
And by
a restaurant or a tavern, yes.
Right, and then they find the tavern or the restaurant owner's body in his trunk of his car out at O'Hare Airport. Before they actually found the two guys that he killed in the drum. So the detective, we talked to one of the detectives, investigated this, and what they found out was there was another guy that was killed too, who was involved with this, and who was involved in hiding the bodies. They found out, and they cleared it, what they call an exceptional clearance, because the guy who killed the two guys was then later killed. So they cleared all three.
By that way, if they did,
Bob,
yeah, without going to trial.
Right.
I do remember that story. I did get some ink. I did have some clippings, I remember, on that. I didn't do the story, but I remember reading about it and talking about it with people. And it was one of those, again, if you call it minor echelon. Trouble is, we had so many hits some years that the ones that were big, not big names, didn't get a lot of play.
Really?
Like John, as I mentioned, was one in Case, and then the other one you up. But that was fascinating. You're right. There were two bodies found on that drum, stuffed in that drum. That's right. Yeah.
Well, there has to be another kind of a duo, although they didn't end up in a drum. We spent some time doing an interview with Frank Culotta.
Frank Culotta, from Las Vegas.
You remember Frank and working under Tony Spilotro. And he made
you're turning out books all the time, right?
He was telling us about there's that scene from the movie Casino where they're running through the house and shooting and the guy won't die. And Frank made the mention about loading his own rounds, half loading rounds, which when we had done an episode about the Ken Ito assassination attempt, it was the same situation where these Chicago guys were loading their own rounds, like light loading them so they wouldn't make so much noise. Mm-hmm. And in the case of Ken Ito, it didn't kill him and it got those guys killed. Obviously, Frank was able to kill the guy.
Didn't I think, if I remember, in the movie Casino, Culotta himself was in that picture.
Yeah, he was.
As a hitter. And I think that scene when he ran by, I think that was, he might have been referring to that, where he plugged a guy, came out of his door and he shot him in the daylight, but it looked like a motel or something like that, or a hotel.
Yeah, and then they strangle him and the cord breaks and end up...
Culotta, of course, has been, that's been some time, he was a part of the Hole in the Wall gang. He came over here, a couple of times they didn't have him testify, they questioned some of his credibility, but... He did testify against the Spilotro brothers in a 1962 murder, but they were acquitted in that case. And he did not testify in the family secrets case, like a lot of people assumed he were, but they decided the government not to use him. But Frank's done very well for himself. He's had at least two books out there. And I think, does he have a museum of his own or something?
He's got a mob tour. Frank Culotta's Casino movie tour.
Yeah. Anybody can just call him up. And go meet him. He'll meet you and then take you on a mob tour and then go into a pizza place and have pizza with you. That guy is...
But he always sits in the back passenger seat on the right.
He's done very well for himself.
Yes.
He's been a governor. He's retired. I think you're talking over 30 years that he has been out of the outfit. I mean, and I'm sure that some of the people around on Spilotro and Company were unhappy what he did. He came forward. But, of course, he went in that witness program and... The government is protecting them, and nowadays things nothing's going to happen to them anymore.
Not anymore. Well, they're all dead.
So, but really, the kind of the cue there being, as we could bring up Frank, was Tony Spilotro and his brother Michael. Were you were working at that time as well?
Oh, I remember the Spilotro. I went up to Vegas. I figured I don't think there's any electronic reporter that did more than I did on Spilotro. I figured I was the first guy that I remember. I was at a gambling raid. And one of the carpenters, this was the 19th, right when I first came with the station, I came with it from BBM, from IND, 69. It was a raid late, I was working late at night. We happened to be at 11th and State, and they said, hey, they got Tony Spilotro in here. Now, I'd heard about him before, that he was an up and comer, and we went to get pictures of him, some tape with film, not tape, with film in those days. I remember he covered up at that time. And that's when I started to have quite a fascination with him, because he once vowed at that time, they told me that he was going to rule the Chicago mob someday. And it appeared that he might. As it turned out, he moved up the ladder very quickly, went out to look after Chicago mob's interests in Las Vegas. And then, of course, it was killed in 86. And by the way, the story, I dispute myself as to why he was killed. The story was, of course, mostly the story was told. The one that supposedly what happened was that they thought he was too risky. He was bringing too much heat on the authorities and the mob because of his activities at the jewel store in Las Vegas. And that also he had... not reported on some of his scores to share with the outfit people back in Chicago, that is, some of the jewel heists that he was responsible for there. I don't think that's true at all. I think what happened was, in my opinion, this was in 1986, that he went back to Chicago, this is in the spring of 86, and met apparently with Accardo, either in Chicago or at his home in California, winter home in California, making a bid to take over, because Accardo was aging, and Iupa had just been convicted, along with Jackie Cerrone and La Petra, and the leadership of the Chicago mob. In other words, the leadership had been blown away, and Spilotro was making a bid for that, along with Joe Ferriola, who was his only challenger, who was at that time sort of the chief enforcer in the Chicago mob and a very, very strong leader. And I think what happened, it was a power struggle. I think Ferriola ordered him killed. He was lured back to Chicago with his brother, and they were murdered. And I think that's what I think happened. That's just my opinion. I could be wrong and probably are, but I mean, that's one version that a lot of people don't think about. And I think that's what really why he was killed.
Yeah, that's probably as good as any. And I never did like the story about him having an affair with Lefty Rosenthal's wife and all that.
Well, that's pretty legitimate. That happened.
He may have, but they wouldn't kill a guy and his brother over that.
No. I don't think that caused that. In fact, I went out and did a special on Lefty Rosenthal before he even did anything on the networks of that. And he didn't want to talk much about it. One of the things he wouldn't talk about was the attempt on his life. When he came out, it was at Tony Romo's, and the car was blown up. And he didn't want to say too much about his wife, but he had two kids, and he was training them to be great swimmers. And I remember he was very embittered about his wife not doing things to help him out, and that was the extent of that. But, of course, she died of an overdose in the Los Angeles area when they finally separated. But she was a wild one, I guess, and they had a lot of problems there, I'm sure of that.
So let me get your opinion on one thing. Jane Ann Morrison of the Las Vegas Review-Journal recently published an article in which she had sources, FBI sources, that are now saying that Lefty Rosenthal was a top echelon informant during all this time. What do you think about that? It appears to me as probably true, because he didn't even have to come and testify or go before the grand jury. They didn't do anything to him during the skim trials. What do you think about that?
You're right on that. That's a good point. That was back in, you're right, at 86, and here he was alive and well at that time. You're right. No, he could have been. There's no question that his gambling acumen was very high. I mean, they thought very highly of him because he could generate a lot of money of him. And of course, he was Jewish, you know, he wasn't part of the outfit in the sense that he can't ever be made. But you're right, he may have had, it's hard to say what, and the murder, why he was murdered there like that, or not attempt on him, whether it had something to do with Spilatro's, whether Spilatro wanted to do it, I think we'll never know. But that's an interesting point. I'm sure the guy out in Vegas, the writer there with the Paper Review Journal, they got some pretty good sources, I don't doubt that. So I would respect what he had to say about it.
I think it was interesting that when we spoke with Frank Culotta, and we did talk about Tony Spilatro, and because
What did Culotta say as far as the death of the attempt on Lefty's wife? What did he feel was the reason for that?
Oh, he didn't talk about. We talked about Tony and Michael, and he basically in that conversation about them being killed, they were beaten to death, happened in a basement, and he felt that Anthony, since he was like 10 or 12 years old, mm-hmm. that Anthony knew he was going in and felt he could talk his way out of it.
Well, there's no question. He said that it came out in trial that he told his wife, if we're not back by a certain time, he had a little ill feeling about going to that meeting, where supposedly he thought that his brother was going to be made and he was going to get a promotion, that Tony was going to get a promotion, that he had apparently some ill feeling of, he was concerned about it, that he might not come out of a life. You're right. He was definitely concerned about that. At least his wife testified to that during that trial, if I recall.
Yeah, and
of course he was killed.
And Culotta didn't say, I don't know, I'm trying to remember if he said anything about Rosenthal.
I think he did, not about Lefty, but he did indicate he thought that Spilatro was killed because of screwing everything up in Las Vegas and bringing all the heat down in Las Vegas.
Well, that's one of the arguments that people thought initially. Now, bear in mind also that Frank at that time, when Spilatro was killed, was 86, was no longer with the outfit. He had defected to the government by that time.
Yeah.
So he probably might have been passing on what he heard. I don't know. But no, that's the general. A lot of people have said that, but I'm going to go to my grave with won't be an early one anymore. And I still think there was a power struggle. That's what I feel.
And I think even Frank affirmed the fact that the feds had come along and they had recordings of people whose voices he knew. I guess it was of Tony talking with folks back in Chicago that told him that Tony needed to clean his dirty laundry.
And Frank realized he was part of that dirty laundry.
And Frank,
well, don't forget that Pilato had been on trial so many times, he'd bring a lot of heat. In fact, he was one of the defendants, as you well know, in the Skim case. He was severed because he had a heart condition. He'd had surgery. And he was scheduled then to go back on trial in May. He went back on trial in Las Vegas in May on forget the charge right now, and there was a hung jury. And so he had to have a rematch on that. So he was continually going. He lived a charmed life. The guy was always, it seemed, on trial, but was never convicted. And he came back to Chicago in June. And that was when, of course, he was lured back to Chicago. And that's when he was killed. But you're right. You can make an argument, as Culotta and others have done, that he was putting too much heat on them. And that maybe, as I said before, that some people thought that he was keeping some of the swag from these jewelry heists to himself. He's bringing up too much heat on the people in Las Vegas and the whole mob as a whole. But again, as I say, I think there was a power struggle. I think the real Fallon was Ferriola, who was a very ambitious and a very ruthless guy. He put the quietus on Mr. Spilotro because of that.
Who came up after Accardo? I don't know the Chicago
Accardo
history.
Accardo was in semi. He was in semi-retirement. He was still the emeritus. He was still, no question, he had major hits or anything like that. I would think it must have been Accardo must have okayed it. I cannot believe that they would have killed the two brothers without Accardo's okay. I can't believe it. I find that hard to believe. Normally, that would Iupa would do it, and maybe Iupa gave him. Iupa was in jail, but that didn't mean he couldn't make decisions like that. But of course, at the Kansas City thing came down in January, and the murder was in June.
Right. Now, so did Joe Ferriola then ascend to the head of the outfit?
No, Ferriola is being the person that ascended to take over the Chicago outfit.
That's correct. And he was very thought very highly by Accardo when I was told, and that he was the numero uno. And what happened to him, happened to Ferriola was physical illness, nothing to do with his decisions with running the outfit, but he came down with cancer, and then he was down at the Houston DeBakey, I think it worked on him. I might be sure about that on the cancer, but then he had a heart condition and he died through natural causes, and that left a vacuum. And when he died, there's been a real power vacuum ever since. And I think as far as any strong leadership are concerned, and I think after that too, that's when Chicago moved out of Las Vegas. I mean, why they did that, I don't know. They definitely lost their influence out there. Why they did that, I don't know. But they retrenched after the two boys were killed. And to this day, I don't know. I don't think anybody really knows why, but they did. And it became sort of an open city. Before that, I think most people felt that that Chicago really had the major voice in what was going on in Las Vegas. And that happened before him when they had a guy named Marshall Caifano running the show as well, not just Spilotro. Well, and John Roselli before that. So they had their own people out there for some time.
Speaking of Las Vegas, let's go ahead and finish this off with your account of coming to Kansas City and attending the skim trials. So
I'll tell you, right. What happened was, for the people that don't remember that, is, of course, the real leadership. There was probably the biggest, I think, that in my lifetime, and this is the biggest mob story of all. We had the leadership of the Chicago mob, Kansas City, Milwaukee, and Cleveland all going on trial and taking money or skimming money from Las Vegas casinos. If convicted, the men that were mostly older were going to spend a great deal of time in prison, perhaps their life. And I went down to cover it. Well, we weren't there every day for it, but we went for it to start. When Roy Williams testified, we were there also with that. And then, of course, later on, and then you had the final arguments and the jury out for some days. And so you got acquainted with these guys, batting the breeze. You talked to them like Cerrone off camera. You could do that. But it was a fascinating trial. And I think I mentioned before that Kansas City was smart enough. Dave Helfrey, I think, was the prosecutor on that, if I recall.
You're right.
And he realized as a hot property, I think the Chicago Strike Force, the Justice Department in Chicago, did not think that was as good a deal. He took it and ran with it. And to my knowledge, it's been one of the biggest mob trials you'll find, because the results was it really crippled the Chicago organization. The outfit really staggered him, with the top leadership going down. And that was true also in Milwaukee. Frank Balistrieri was pleading guilty. Kansas City was disseminated after that trial. And so there you had those three markets that were really battered by what happened. And the top leadership of all those families went down the drain one way or the other. They had either died or pled guilty and so on and so forth. And that is, we are down there as I indicate that. I tell you one thing I remember, I enjoyed Kansas City. There was great restaurants there, the Golden Ox and the Herford House. And I remember going to the Golden Ox the only time I was there. Lo and behold, who was there the night we were in there? Joey Iupa and his entourage were there. I remember that only too well. They knew a good thing. They knew where they could stay. I'll tell you that. And one other story can I give? It's not mob-related, but they had a Democratic convention there, I think in 70, whatever, one year it was down there.
I think that was the one that Gary was working.
76, okay, we had the Republican National Convention.
But the story was on the Golden Knox, a friend of my cameraman, who was pretty streetwise, went down there to eat, and there's a big line waiting to get in. And he was in line like just everybody else. And he said that Warren Beatty, and I know who was with her, but I think it was part of this Hollywood entourage came in to see the maitre d' to get immediate seating, of course, and they were told to go back to the end of the line. And I remember the cameraman said, that's the best thing that ever happened. Those guys need, they got to act like everybody else. And unfortunately, the Golden Ox is no more.
Yeah, and the Hereford House burned down.
I know, you and that's terrible. But Kansas City was like a miniature Chicago in some ways. Yeah. You had a city that was a big railhead. You had a big meatpacking city there. You had an organized, strong organized crime town there. Great baseball town. I remember the Kansas City Blues in the American Association would draw very well and so on and so forth. And of course, you had a very good outfit there too. And it was a great, it was a, it reminded me a lot about Chicago, very much so.
Interestingly enough, I don't know if this name is familiar at all. When we talk about the Hereford House, Vince Pesciotta.
No?
He wouldn't know him. He's a young, he was a young mob guy here in Kansas City that never really, he might have become made if they still make people in his later on. That burning in the Hereford House was actually one mob member and one mob associate, a guy named Mark Sorrentino,
burnt that down
as an arson for hire. It's the usual story. You've heard it 1,000 times up there in Chicago. Local businessman gets overextended, tries to start another restaurant, and it's not going so well, and he cash flow is bad, and what we used to call Italian remodeling, and then all of a sudden the place burns down.
Well, we call it in Chicago Greek lightning.
Greek lightning, yeah. I've heard it called Jewish lightning. You know, we're not real politically correct on this show here.
Why isn't it Italian lightning?
By the way, speaking of Kansas City, I know that the mob, you mentioned Harry Alleman. There were stories at the time. If I remember right, you people in Kansas City, there was an area right down the river they were trying to develop. The mob was. Am I correct?
The River Key. Yeah, oh, yeah.
What they call it?
The River Key. They had a big mob war over that.
Alleman was sent down there to keep some of those guys in order. In other words, there's a couple of murders that they felt he was responsible for.
Yeah, well, I have heard
that.
How
true that was, I don't know. Yeah, that was the street talk.
Yeah, I heard that about one of them. Actually, I read it in some news article, and then I remember at the time, but I always doubted that story. And I mean, we had plenty of hitters here that
without importing. Yeah, I know that.
Who was their explosives expert, though? I mean,
in Kansas City?
No, two buildings blew up.
Yeah.
And they could never really find evidence. There's somebody had to know something about explosives.
Well, one guy was Gene Shepard. He knew how to make a bomb, and he just died recently, got out of the joint and died recently. Mm-hmm. So he was a bomb expert. There was another one that Carl Spiro had that could make a remote control detonated bomb, but we never figured out who it was.
He just had to get close enough to get it to work.
And that Johnny Brocato that got killed early in the River Key thing, he was an electrician, and he was suspected of doing some bomb making too. So they had plenty of bomb makers. You had a good electrician and maybe a guy done a little time in the military, you could make a bomb.
They could do that, sure. But for example, in Chicago, one of the guys that was an outfit guy later was killed, called Jimmy the Bomber Katura.
Oh yeah, I've heard of him. He was part of that chop shop.
Then they had another guy called, they called him Pineapples, because not because he liked the fruit for pineapple, but because he could throw them pineapples around. So where the hell true that was, I don't know.
Well, you know, John, the mob has provided me and you with a good living.
I got to admit that. That's right. I got no beef. That's exactly right. A couple of pay raises. I won't deny that. You hit it on the head. You came right to the strength on this stuff. So I'm crying in my beer. I'll tell you, when Spilotro was killed, we used to make a lot of trips out to Las Vegas. Yeah. Business was over. There's nothing to go out there for. We went out one time afterwards, and that was it. But those kind of stories. And that's not baloney. That's gospel, I'm telling you. My show was over. My Vegas show days were over.
Well, you retired from working in the television news reporting and media, and then have gone on to do some books of your own.
Yeah, I've written several books, and we still freelance a bit and things of that nature. We did freelance on both our television and also on radio shows here, and we still worked up until recently for the station periodically as a freelancer. So we've been busy in that sense.
You got some titles of your books. I suppose they're all on Amazon.
Yeah, they are. There's one is 30 Years in the Trenches, covering crooks, characters, and capers. 30 Years in the Trenches, covering crooks, characters, and capers. And the other one is called It Ain't Pretty, But It's Real.
That's a great title. It is.
They don't like the fit. They buy the paper. Remember that. They can always wrap fish in it. They don't like it. So get some use out of it.
Now, were you friends with, is it Cozell? Ron Kozel, is that how you pronounce it?
Yes, and Ron is deceased. Yeah, Ron.
He's deceased now, I know.
It was Kozel and John O'Brien. John O'Brien was down for the trial, and the trial of the Skim case, and Ron Kozel did a lot of mob stories, and both those men today, unfortunately, are both deceased.
Yeah,
they died fairly young. They weren't that old.
When I started looking into this and getting somebody out of Chicago, I had seen so many articles by Kozel that I wanted to get him, but... course
he did in Las Vegas a lot. John, he died not that old. Ron has been dead for some time, and O'Brien suffered from cancer.
Yeah.
And Bob Weidrich was a columnist that did a lot of organized crime stuff, and then Art Patak for the Sun Times. I have to admit, all those gentlemen are now gone. They're gone.
Yeah. We're going to be talking to a man named Harry Jones Jr. Harry Jones from Kansas City, who was with the Star for a long time. He actually lives in Chicago now. He covered the mob here for all during the 60s and the 70s.
And well, he'd be an interesting guy. That'll be a good interview.
And he also was part of that IRE, the Investigator and Reporters and Editors, and went out to Phoenix and worked on that Don Bowles case.
Well, he can tell you more about Don Bowles than I can. So, that's quite a story.
I'm going to use him to talk about that as well as the Kansas City mob. So this has been fun. You're the third guy. We had Anthony DiStefano from New York City, and Larry Henry from Las Vegas, who mainly, he didn't cover the mob that much, but he worked around and knew a lot about New Dead Day personally, so he told us Ned Day's story, and so we're going to continue
about
doing
Ned Day,
this.
Yeah, who was a friend of mine, yes.
So, you know, the reason I started this, John, was because I realize as I get older, that how important the media was in this fight against organized crime.
Absolutely, there's no question about that. Exposing it kept them. Absolutely, there's no denying that. I think the media did a lot. The Justice Department and local authorities can do so much, but the media helped keep the spotlight on these guys. That's what
it
did.
Right. That was. I mean, when they can operate behind the scenes, they can get away with a lot more. And so you guys would shine the light on their little games and keep the local crime commissions fired up and get law enforcement fired up a little bit when they start seeing those headlines of those bodies dropping. All of a sudden the budgets get loosened up and you start putting a few more officers or agents on particular cases, which is what happened in Kansas City.
The public pressure, that's right. Pressure that makes a lot of difference. You betcha it does. You've got a very valid point there. There's no denying that.
The main reason that little bug was put in the Villa Capri restaurant, in which Bill Owsley and the other agents who were listening mm-hmm. heard Tuffy DeLuna and Corky Savella talking about skimming from Las Vegas to start that case, was because of all these murders in that River Key area that we talked about a few minutes ago, kind of a new development in Kansas City, and we had a little bit of a mob war going on. Well, there were some bodies dropping because of that. And with those bodies dropping, the agents, they transferred some more agents in and the whole intelligence unit geared up and really focused on these guys. And we were working overtime and following people around. And because of that, they got the probable cause to put that first microphone in. And
I'll be darned.
And
I didn't know that.
That's how it got started.
Yeah.
And then out of that,
I did not know that.
Tuffy DeLuna made kind of a fatal slip. You know, that what they were saying would not have led to anything other than they knew it was about Las Vegas. They knew it was about Teamsters. They knew it was about millions of dollars. They knew it was about a guy named Lefty and a guy called Genius and a guy mm-hmm. called Caesar and a guy called Crazy. And they knew that it was in Las Vegas. But Tuffy said, you know, we got to call that guy. He said, I got to call that guy. He said, I got to find a phone. And so when he said that, we did a full court press surveillance on Tuffy with, I don't know, it must have been 20 of us and airplanes. And we caught him using payphones. And boy, the payphones were the gold mine. That's when it all started spilling out. So that's how
that
started.
That's very interesting.
Mainly because of all the media pressure on us, on the Kansas City Police and on the FBI. I mean, you feel that, and plus you just put it on yourself. When you see that in the paper all the time, you think your friends or your fellow officers are going, hey, what are you guys doing? Aren't you guys doing anything? So you kind of double down and work a little bit harder, put a little money into it.
There was
when did you leave the department, the PD there?
1996. I was on from 71 to 96.
20 years ago. Time flies.
Oh, man, I know.
you hate to think if you think, look back when I started talking about this, and my God, that's a long time ago.
I know.
It was seems kind like of... only yesterday, but it isn't. No, time goes by, unfortunately. Really? You get older. It's not good.
It's kind of the cool off
but
period.
But say hello to Red. We met again because he's the guy that I think got you that.
Yeah, he is.
Gary, you got my number. Anytime, give me a quick.
All right, John. Oh, I really appreciate
enjoyed
you
it very
doing
much. Had a lot of fun.
All right.
All right. We'll see you now. Bye.
Thank you, sir.
All right. Well, that was a great interview, man. Wow. That's going to be that's a bonus one there. That's going to be about an hour and 30 minutes,
just
I think.
By itself.
20 minutes altogether.
People are going to get that first half hour, and they're going to be, what?
And it's going to be all information. It's going to be, I mean, it was dense. It was filled with really good information about the Chicago outfit and what he did with them. So, man, that was a great interview. I'm glad I was able to get a hold of him. You know, our friend Redwood Metz, the reason that I got him, he may not have even talked to me but he called him up and said, you know, I know this guy and he'll do a good job on the interview because he did a good job on my interview. So a big shout out to our friend Red and you know, Red's got a book out there, folks. I thought it was a really well done book. And plus it was the inside story. It was from a guy talk about out of the mouth of the men that did it. Red Womet. It's, what's the name of that book?
What was that? What they did and how? What I did about it? I'm trying to remember the title.
Just a minute. I'll
pull it up here and we'll edit this down to.
I'll cut that back in. Yeah, Aaron, the title of Red's book is Nobody Cares and What I Did About It, The Red Womet Story of the Chicago Outfit by Red Womet. And you can get it. You can get an autographed copy at his website, www.nobodycaresaboutit and What I Did, or just Google Red Womet and. Chicago Outfit, or of course it's on Amazon. Just run Red Womet's name on Amazon.
And he's on Twitter.
Oh, is he? I didn't really realize that. He's on Facebook. He's on that Chicago. Here's a really good Chicago site for you guys.
He's on Twitter at Red Womet, WEMETTE. It says Raymond Clemens, and he's at Red Womet, former FBI/ATF. Organized crime informant for over 20 years and author of Nobody Cares and What I Did About It.
Yeah, Red often posts on Facebook. He's got his own Facebook page, of course, that Nobody Cares About It and What I Did, something along those lines. But he's often on this really great Chicago Outfit site called the Chicago Outfit Old and Current News and Articles. This Mike Byrne that runs it, he posts all kinds of great articles from the Chicago Tribune, that guy we mentioned, Ron Koziel, and all kinds of other organized crime information, all only about it, Chicago only. You can post on his site, but don't post anything unless it's about Chicago. And he's a good guy. I've had some interaction with him, and he runs a really good site. There's no trolling his the post and that kind of crap on his. So it's one of there's several Chicago Outfit sites. I think that's one of the better ones. So I think it's time for me to say you got anything else over there, Aaron?
No, I'd just like to say thank you to Jonas Appert from Sweden.
From Sweden. He has been quite interactive with me on Facebook.
And of course, Dean from Ireland. We want to give him a shout out. And our new friend, Ben Ellickson. Chicago.
And Dean, I forgot. I just got this the other day. Dean made a nice little donation. So thank you, Dean.
Thank you very much.
Okay. If you have a friend or relative with a problem with drugs or alcohol, make your first call to First Call. Call 816-361-5900 or go to their website, www.firstcallkc.org. What do you got to say to that, Aaron?
I got to say, folks, you need to go back and listen to over 150 episodes of Gangland Wire. If you hadn't heard them before, you could go back and hear them again. They're all free. And subscribe. That way you're going to get the notice when Gary posts up a brand new episode, like the one we just recorded with John Drummond. And they come out on Mondays at 4 a.m. So subscribe and get that notice automatically. Then what you want to do is go over to Amazon, where you can buy your own copy, digitally download, of Gangland Wire, the documentary that started it all. And when you're watching that and it tickles your interests, what you're going to want to do is go get Gary's app, the Kansas City Mob Tour. You can take your own personalized tour of notorious mob locations in and around Kansas City. And when you're taking that tour, you're going to get more interested in the mob, and you're going to want to hear more about that. To do that, what you're going to want to do is get the book that Gary just wrote, Leaving Vegas.
How FBI wiretaps ended mob domination of Las Vegas casinos.
The words from the mouth of the men that did it. Get the Kindle, and you can hear them saying it themselves. And if all of that really isn't enough, you can become a Gangland Wire mob associate or made member for a simple donation of $50 or more.
Yeah, or you can be a Soto Capo, which is an underboss, or you can be a capo, or you can be the capo de tutti de capi. If you give us enough money, you will be the boss of all bosses. I think that's only in your city, though.
In your city.
In your city, because we are worldwide. Big shout out to our new friends from Ireland. We did some Irish shows and put some up on Facebook and some linked them on Facebook, and I got quite a few new followers from Ireland. So welcome all you new folks from Ireland. We are worldwide.
And remember to give us a review. Go to iTunes, and if you really love the episodes, tell us. And when you do those reviews, of course, it ranks us up a little higher, and then more people will find Gangland Wire.
All right. Say goodnight, Aaron.
Goodnight, Aaron. Bumper music provided by Odd-O-Matic. Find them on Facebook at Odd-O-Matic Music.
Bang! I got shot in the head.
Who do you believe ordered the hit on you, Mr. Ito?
Vincent Solano. Second time I got shot, I thought, well, it's not taking an effect.
Is Mr. Solano your boss in the outfit?
Yes, he is.